Hello, everyone. Welcome to the pre-presentation podcast for Science of Practicing Medicine. This month, May, we are going to be talking about major updates in COPD and asthma with Dr. Patta Ramakant. Hi, how are you?
Hi, Dr. Lucio.
Thank you for joining me today, and thanks a lot for doing the presentation.
It's absolutely my pleasure.
Great. Let's get right into it. We kind of discussed about doing this, and you were like right into talking about updates in asthma and COPD. So first off, is this something of your clinical interest in particular?
I'm a pulmonologist by practice, so half of my practice harbors more COPD and asthma patients.
Sure.
Of course, my special interest is in ILD and pulmonary hypertension, but I do share passion regarding COPD and asthma. I kind of do some clinical research here for COPD and asthma, so share my passions there.
That's fantastic. So I'm always interested in hearing about clinical research. So that's within CentraCare?
Yeah, within CentraCare, our site got approved for tezepelumab. It's called Tezspire. Uh-huh. For COPD patients. There's strict inclusion-exclusion criteria, and then we're going to initiate the trial soon.
Okay, so this trial is not FDA approved?
This is phase 3 trial.
Phase 3.
It's not FDA approved.
Okay.
Yeah, it's sponsored by the company. Yeah.
Well, to navigate around that, what's new in asthma? Let's start with asthma. What's new in asthma treatment?
Oh, yeah. So for decades long, we have been using only inhalers for asthma. And sometimes if the asthma was very severe, we would give oral steroids and then maintain on oral steroids for a long time. And nowadays, we're identifying many different mediators that are responsible for asthma.
Sure.
For example, interleukin-5, interleukin-13, interleukin-4, et cetera. So now we have biologics. Now it's a world of biologics these days. So
sure.
We do have a lot of biologics that affect these mediators. And sometimes my patients say, this is the best Christmas I celebrated. It's like a miracle injection. Likewise. So it's pretty exciting. You know, once a person is on high dose inhaled steroids for the control of asthma or oral steroids for the control of asthma, now we have a lot of options to choose from, depending on the comorbidities. Yeah.
Yeah. So the first question that I have is to ask it in this straightforward way. Is it old fashioned to just use, you know, inhaled steroids, oral steroids as needed, and beta agonists, I think, is the other ones?
Yeah. I mean, the treatment of asthma, the cornerstone of treatment of asthma is inhaled steroids, period. That's the cornerstone of asthma. We are not supposed to use LAMAs or LABAs without inhaled steroids for asthma because that seems to increase mortality. You know, it's related to inflammation in the airways or so. But sometimes despite increasing inhaled steroids or systemic steroids, sometimes asthma remains uncontrolled. Or it could be that high-dose inhaled steroids can have adverse effects in the long term, like osteoporosis,
yes,
glaucoma, cataracts. In that situations, it may be preferable to use biologics that will enable us to wean us from these high-dose inhaled steroids or oral steroids.
So in whether there's data or in your experience, what percentage of patients remain with just good old steroids and what are moving more towards biologicals, I'd say?
Yeah, I mean, our primary care physicians are doing a great job. So by the time we have a referral for asthma, it's typically uncontrolled asthma. So almost 80 to 90% of people that I see, I end up starting biologics. That's because, you know, the primary care physicians and the referral physicians are doing a great job of initiating them on LABA ICS inhalers.
And the first ones that were around were the interleukin blockers, right? Was interleukin 13 or 6?
Yeah, there are three interleukins that we target. Interleukin 5, which is an eosinophil mediator, and interleukin 4 and interleukin 13. So there are different molecules and different combinations that work on different interleukin receptors. Like, for example, mepolizumab, it works on interleukin 5. For example, dupilumab, brand name is Dupixent. It works on interleukin 4, interleukin 13, likewise.
Okay.
And there is something called Tezspire that works on TSL mediator that's way high up in the hierarchy. So if they do not respond to these interleukin 5, interleukin 13, interleukin 4 biologics, then we go to another medication called Tezspire.
Okay. And that's used by pulmonologists only, or primaries are using it also?
No, I think biologics are typically used by pulmonologists.
Okay, an allergy, I presume.
An allergy, yeah. That's right, yeah.
Okay, and then is there anything ahead of that that is approved already, or that's all is approved so far?
Yeah, there are many new medications that are being considered in the research. Like, for example, potentially next year we'll be starting a trial here by the help of pharmaceutical company, an oral biologic rather than injection, rather than subcutaneous.
Neat.
And there is IV biologic that is approved. I've never used it before. IV requires IV administration, so I've never used it. And asthma sometimes can have bronchiectasis. Like, for example, ABPA, aspergillus, is known to cause bronchiectasis, and that can have severe asthma exacerbation. In those situations, we use this. There is a phase 2 clinical trial with interleukin-33, that acts on interleukin-33, that specifically deals with bronchiectasis. It's very exciting.
Interesting. So it sounds like everything deals with interleukin pathways and TSL you mentioned.
Right now, I think in the next 10 years, it's going to be more endotyping. What kind of obstructive airway disease a patient has? Is it eosinophilic? Is it neutrophilic? Is it interleukin-5 mediated, interleukin-30 mediated, so that we can do a targeted therapy, similar to oncology? You know, oncology is exciting nowadays. We are targeting mutations and all that. Similar to that, I think in the next 5 to 10 years, we will come with a good classification of endotypes of obstructive airway diseases.
Okay. And then as a side door into COPD, I was reading that there's a subtype of COPD that is eosinophilic. So they're using, what's the brand name, Dupixent?
Dupixent. That's right. So if you know the history of COPD and asthma, there are two kinds of hypotheses, something called British hypothesis, where they classify COPD completely different to that of asthma. They're considered as two different entities. And there's a Dutch hypothesis, which is a very interesting hypothesis. It states that COPD and asthma are two ends of the same spectrum. And it's just a matter of what cell is involved in the inflammation. Like, if it's more eosinophilic inflammation, it's more goes towards asthma. And that's why you see a bronchodilator response. And if it's more neutrophilic and lymphocytic, TH1, TH2, switch, that decides more with the patient would have COPD. That's an interesting hypothesis. And right now, Dupixent was initially approved for asthma, eosinophilic asthma. Uh-huh. And nowadays, we are using Dupixent for COPD patients with eosinophil count greater than 300. Now, it's not a magic drug for COPD, but I do see decreased number of exacerbations in COPD.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Let me ask you around this because it's interesting. So somebody smokes and that creates rise inflammation. So some of these people could have eosinophilic-driven inflammation. That's a theory.
That's right. So when we smoke all these particles, it is the products in the combustion that are more irritants, and it releases some mediators called alarmins in our respiratory tract. And these alarmins can either activate TH1 or TH2, and that significantly decides the switch, whether the eosinophils are activated, lymphocytes are activated, or neutrophils are activated. And that leads to either emphysema or chronic bronchitis, two different clinical phenotypes in COPD.
Fascinating.
Yeah.
So is there pathophysiological evidence, like bench research evidence of this?
There is good amount of evidence for the murine models.
Okay.
And now we do have good phase 2 trials indicating that, for example, Dupixent works for decreasing mucus production, mucus plugging. There's good phase 3 data that Dupixent decreases the score of mucus plugging on the CT scans and decreases the number of exacerbations likewise. So it is spilling over to the clinical practice, clinical research right now.
Interesting. And there's any correlation with increasing IgE or eosinophilia, peripheral eosinophilia, or in the lavage, even if you do a BAL?
Yeah, there was a recent study published last month, I guess. They did mucosal biopsies via bronchoscopy after starting biologics. And they do see significant improvement in inflammation and the eosinophil ratio that is noted in the mucosa. Again, these are, again, pilot studies. Yeah. It's difficult to do a complete study where it might require autopsy and all that if you really want to look into all different layers of the airways.
It's fascinating to see, to try and morph.
It's going to be great, I think, in the next 5 to 10 years. And nowadays, the new phase 2 trials are even more interesting. For example, chronic bronchitis, there is something called as bronchial rhinoplasty. that kind of uses electrical current to charge the blue blood cell hyperplasia that decreases mucus production. Now, decreasing mucus production is very important because it not only improves the breathing, it decreases the rate of exacerbations, decreases pneumonia as well. And mucus is essentially protein, dead cells, sugar, and salt. It's a great culture medium for bacteria. The more mucus plugging, the more pneumonia. So by doing the rheoplasty, they have noted, I mean, I think the results are yet to be published, but phase two trial recruitment is done. They have done multiple procedures. It's two procedures, 30 days apart, decreases mucus production. Similarly, there is something called lung denervation. That's again phase two. If a COPD person has multiple exacerbations, we can do bronchoscopic lung denervation, and that seems to decrease the exacerbation rates. So it's going to be exciting, I think, with biologics and approval of all these therapies.
Or we might as well just ban smoking and we are done.
That's a preventative measure,
All right, that's fascinating stuff. So beyond the subclass of eosinophilia, right, or eosinophilic background, is there any new treatments otherwise other than the what you mentioned that are more like
Absolutely. Now COPD is classified into different flavors. Nowadays there is potentially we are considering pre-COPD, like pre-diabetes. We are considering pre-COPD. It requires a more critical analysis of PFT, but pre-COPD is one entity. And there is something called a small airway collapse, which is not typically identified by FEV1 by FVC ratio. We need to compare FVC and slow vital capacity ratio. That's a small airway collapse phenotype. And there's another phenotype called as vascular phenotype of COPD, wherein they have mild obstruction, but potentially they have pre-capillary pulmonary hypertension. The classification allows us to try multiple different agents that are specific to their pathophysiology. And there is new treatment called ensifentrine. It's a nebulized medication. It was approved like 6 months ago in the U.S. We've been using it in clinical practice. I get good feedback from my patients. It's a PDE3 and PDE4 inhibitor. But of course, it's a new drug. It requires approval by the insurance and all that.
So it makes me think sometimes I'll see these, you know, I don't want to say old, but elder smokers that you know, with COPD, and you see a diagnosis of asthma. So I always wonder how you tell apart, but probably now it's more a phenotypic description.
So asthma, by definition, it's a variable expiratory flow obstruction. And it should be reversible. If you can demonstrate that, either by demonstrating that expiratory flow is variable, either by FEV1 or peak expiratory flow, and it's completely reversible, that indicates asthma. Whereas COPD is irreversible, persistent airflow obstruction. So that's the reason why the GOLD guidelines come with a value of FEV1 by FVC less than 70. Or American Thoracic Society, European Respiratory Society, they say the ratio of FEV1 by FVC less than lower limit of normal. That essentially classifies asthma and COPD. But I think in future, we will be classifying more of endotypes than phenotypes. I think in the next 5-10 years, it will be more eosinophilic obstructive airway disease, neutrophilic obstructive airway disease.
That's fascinating. How do you think, what's your experience on how do we do by the time a patient gets to you with the care of asthma and COPD in the primary care realm?
Yeah, primary care, I think asthma, the family physicians and primary care physicians do a great, great job.
Okay.
I think with COPD, we would like them to be referred early than late.
Okay.
Like, for example, I mean, I'll go over my CME lecture, what are the indications for referral to pulmonology.
Sure.
Essentially, one thing I would like to emphasize is we have to be careful in prescribing inhaled steroids to mild to moderate COPD patients. Inhaled steroids in COPD patients may increase the risk of pneumonia, whereas in asthma, that is a cornerstone of the treatment. So the treatment of asthma and COPD varies a little bit. Of course, there are indications of inhaled steroids in COPD as well. Again, we look at the blood eosinophil count. If it is more than 300, go ahead and start inhaled steroids. But if the eosinophil count is less than 300, I would shy away from starting inhaled steroids in a mild to moderate COPD patient. Of course, if it is severe COPD, multiple exacerbations, then that would trump the indication for inhaled steroid.
So there's room for improvement in COPD more than in asthma. But if I read correctly what you're saying, not everybody needs to be referred for COPD.
Absolutely not.
Okay.
If the primary care physician thinks that it's mild to moderate COPD, the symptoms are very well controlled. Mm-hmm. And if it's category A or category B classification of COPD, as long as they start LAMA-LABA, I'm totally fine with it.
Yeah.
If they have multiple exacerbations, greater than two exacerbations in the last 1 year, or somebody who is on oxygen, or somebody who has pulmonary hypertension, or somebody who had multiple exacerbations of COPD requiring urgent care visits or prednisone, then absolutely, please refer to us. We'll be happy to take care of them.
And is anybody in pulmonary, you don't have a particular subgroup of people who are more focused on COPD or asthma?
I think we all split our patients equally.
Mm-hmm.
I think we all take care of ILD, all take care of pulmonary hypertension, COPD, asthma. And if a clinical case is challenging, we do have a discussion within our department on a Wednesday where we discuss about, you know, complicated patients and the best approach there.
Interesting. And there's pulmonary only do you visit sites?
I do go to Alexandria.
Or any, in general, the department, the division.
Yeah, true. For example, two of my colleagues, they go to Wilmer.
Okay.
And I go to Alexandria. Likewise, I think we split.
Okay, so there's
it's an outreach clinic, yeah.
Another general question that I had is, what are you seeing in the world of COPD in particular? Have you noticed that there's decreased smoking, at least in the U.S., and then you see less disease? Do you see earlier onset disease? What are you seeing?
In Minnesota, when I ask the onset of age of smoking, I'm surprised by the answers. They say 13 years of age, 14 years of age, 16 years of age, 17 years of age. They start smoking so early.
For
smoking so early. You know, it just takes 15 to 20 pack years to cause COPD. So mm-hmm. by 45, 50 years, these folks will have some form of COPD or chronic bronchitis or smoking-related parenchymal lung disease. Most of the times when I prescribe varenicline or bupropion for smoking cessation, I do have a success rate of 70%. But it's limited by side effects of nightmares, etc. So, mm-hmm. And some folks tell me I'm not ready to quit. You know, it requires 3 or 4 visits. And once they notice that they have multiple exacerbations, that's when they quit.
Mm-hmm. What do you think of cold turkey? I'm a big fan of cold turkey.
Great. I mean, I love cold turkey, but nicotine is a great addictive chemical. It's a great mm-hmm. addictive chemical. It's one of the most addictive chemicals, more than coffee probably. So probably not judging them. And then as a healthcare advocate, trying to help them giving nicotine replacement therapy. Likewise, vaping is a very controversial topic. It has a good success rate for smoking cessation for those who smoke cigarettes. Mm-hmm. But the problem is the teenagers are catching up with vaping, and we are seeing vaping-induced lung injury these days because of the components associated with vaping. But it's a great strategy. The evidence is great for vaping helping in smoking cessation, but it's a controversial topic. That's why I don't like to discuss further.
Sure.
You know, evidence versus availability, etc.
Last question. There are some diseases, autoimmune disease, colonic malignancy, that are going up and up and up, and we don't know why. Is there any similar data for asthma or not?
Absolutely. There is a controversial hypothesis called hygiene hypothesis. If you've heard about it, you know, the more hygienic we are, the immune system is not stimulated enough. So it goes crazy and activates the allergy component of the immune system that creates asthma. That's one hypothesis. And the second hypothesis is any viral infection during a childhood can trigger that eosinophilic inflammation that is persistent and that seems to have asthma. Again, these are all hypotheses. It has to be proven.
But the numbers are going up or not?
The numbers are going up. Absolutely, the numbers are going up. Yeah,
I hugely support the hygiene. I do infectious disease, right? So here we all roll over dirt and touch the animals, and I always see the immune system as a country's military. If you don't keep it busy, it's gonna go inwards.
Exactly, and, makes sense.
You know, I think it's the healthiest thing. My worst enemy is the hand sanitizer in the house. It's completely forbidden here.
Yeah. And the other component is vitamin D. Typically, if you look at the retrospective data, you know, the vitamin D levels do, I think, I personally believe vitamin D levels do play a role in inflammation and modulation. So if I have a patient with COPD or asthma, I typically want to maintain vitamin D levels around 30 to 40 or so. Less than 30, I kind of prescribe them vitamin D. I do not know, but I did closely examine the data. Overall, the data supports that vitamin D levels until 50 are protective in terms of autoimmune and asthma exacerbations. Again, it requires much more evidence, but again, you know, it's difficult.
I think this is going to be a great presentation. Unfortunately, this is all the time we have. Thank you so much for doing this and for the presentation, which is going to be great for everyone. Thank you, Dr. Pata.
Thank you, Dr. Luzio.